The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Thanks for tuning in to Mix 92.6. This is The Parents Show and I'm Vivian Glass. And if, like me, you're constantly bombarded with requests by your kids for different types of pets, you'll really enjoy this show today with Dean Wiltshire, the owner of Creature Comforts in Harpenden. If I was to say yes to all the different types of pets I get asked for, by now I think I'd have two paddocks, an aviary, and probably a big aquarium in my house. It's a constant conversation that we're having about what types of pets, what might they need. And so I'm really, really pleased to welcome Dean today to the show. And he's going to talk to us a bit about exactly those questions that what do these pets that we might want to welcome into our life need, perhaps of the non-furry variety. Dean, welcome to The Parents Show.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Well, we're really delighted that you can come in and educate us on this subject. So can you just tell us a little bit about Creature Comforts, Dean, to begin with?
Of course. So Creature Comforts, we've purchased the business back in 2016. I'm 29 years old now. I've been keeping animals since I was about 5 years old. And if I'm honest, the passion for the hobby has never died at all. I've gone through multiple different animals over the years. I've had small animals, I've had furry animals, I've had dogs, I've had cats, I've had fish, I've had ferrets, and I've had reptiles since I was about 7 years old. So I've got sort of 20 odd years in the hobby of reptile keeping. Thankful enough, I'm very, very lucky to have opportunities to breed some of these species over the years as well. And yeah, as I say, it's been a great, great passion. It's been very, very enjoyable. Absolutely love what I do. And I love being able to help everyone else with their little animals there.
So Creature Comforts is an independent pet shop, is that right, Dean?
We are indeed, yes. Yeah, we're an independent pet supply specialist. We cater to dogs, we cater to cats, we cater to wild birds, we cater to fish, reptiles, small animals, pretty much any animal that you'd have in a normal household there for you.
Oh, well, that sounds very exciting. And tell us a little bit more about the sorts of considerations. So if somebody's coming into your shop and maybe they don't know much about, let's think about the non-furry pets, for example, what sort of starting points might you give them for considerations that they need to have?
So I would say there's kind of five main questions to consider, first of all. First one being is how long the pet's going to live. Obviously, some of these animals, if we're talking tortoises, animals similar to that, some of those will definitely outlast your childhood there, should we say. Some of these animals can live for 50 plus years, and obviously they are a long, long commitment. So that has to be considered. I mean, there's also the consideration of what space is going to be needed, as you've previously mentioned. Some animals, of course, we're talking no bigger than, let's say, a 16 inch by 16 inch sort of enclosure there. Some animals, of course, we're talking much, much larger. I mean, if we're looking at, let's say, for reticulated pythons, for example, I mean, this is a species that can reach upwards of 20 foot in some cases. So, of course, the enclosure size would need to be suitable there. So, I mean, some animals aren't for everyone, but we try our best to sort of advise what is going to be the best fit for each home there. And, of course, what animal the child is going to be happy with for the foreseeable future. I mean, as I said, some of these animals do have very, very long life expectancies. Most reptiles, I mean, if we're talking, just for example, again, something like a crested gecko, maybe, these animals can live upwards of 15 years easily. So again, it's always something to consider there. The other thing to consider would be sort of what's the daily workload going to be for the animal. So, you know, how much time can you give to cleaning out the animal, to let's say veterinary visits if they're needed, for feeding the animal, even just things like exercising and handling there will also take up parts of the day. So that's always something to be considered there as well. Also, the costs involved of keeping the animal is something to consider. I mean, some of the, if we're talking reptiles, for example, some of the reptiles there you can buy for, let's say, £40 to £50, which to most people seems absolutely amazing. But what you don't see is the hidden costs of the actual setup and the habitat that you need to build in order to keep these animals successfully. Let's say, if we talk along the lines of maybe a bearded dragon, those, as I said, normally around about the £50 mark, depending on what morph you're looking for. Obviously, normal types are always going to be slightly cheaper there. But that's a £50 animal that will need upwards of about £500 all in on an enclosure there. So that's always something to consider as well. Not every animal is suitable for everyone's budget if you do want to keep these animals successfully. The other thing, obviously, to consider is just what animal is your child really wanting there? We see it quite often. People are looking for reptiles, but parents aren't as inclined on the thought there, or aren't as sort of willing to house the animal. So of course, with that, normally they're sort of pushed aside and people end up with, let's say, rabbits or hamsters, but ultimately the child was never sort of overly interested in. So that's always a big consideration is what animal is it that your child is asking for? And if you can't have that animal, what is the closest alternative that will be a better fit to your household, should we say there?
Amazing. And Dean, you know, I always sort of a bit put off because I think you probably need to have a lot of experience or expertise to really give these animals the sort of life that I think they should have. And is that something that you can help with for somebody that's just starting out and is beginning to find their way?
Without a doubt. No, we're always here to help. We're always very, very happy to help. We're thankful to have a very, very small team, but a very, very knowledgeable team here. As I said previously, I mean, I have 20 plus years in the reptile keeping hobby. So most of these species I'm very, very well versed in. We can make great suggestions for what animals are going to be suitable and obviously just help ensure that the correct care is provided long term there. Obviously, we don't want any horror stories of keeping animals. We want everyone to have a good, successful time and enjoy the hobby as much as I do.
And are they high maintenance, Dean?
It really depends on what species you are keeping, if I'm completely honest with you. Some animals are far less hands-on as such, and some animals do require a little bit of handling every now and then. I mean, personally, I don't regularly handle my animals just to keep them sort of as natural as possible there. I mean, we are talking with reptiles especially. These aren't fully domesticated animals as such. Therefore, they don't quite have the same requirements as like a dog or a cat from the sort of the companion standpoint there. But no, they aren't the most time consuming with reptiles. I personally think reptiles are a great fit for most households there. Most people are very, very easily adapted to keeping the reptiles there. Like I say, daily sort of care is quite minimal as such. No animal has no care, let's be honest there. Every animal is going to require some attention from time to time. But no, they're relatively straightforward for the most part. I think once the setup is correct, and that's the most vital part of the reptile keeping side of things, once you have the vivarium or the terrarium set up to the specification that it needs to be, you should have a nice plain sailing successful story there.
And what about the food, Dean? I mean, I know I've looked after my neighbour's gecko and it was all about the live locusts and dipping these in calcium powder before I had to feed them to the gecko alive. And I have to say, I was a bit squeamish. I mean, I know people that have got freezers full of dead mice for their snakes. How gross does this feeding get?
It's not as brutal as it seems, if I'm honest. It can make people a little bit more squeamish. I mean, as you've said there, frozen feeding, things like that there, it's the fairest and safest way to feed the animals. I know in some other places they do have different methods, but thankfully with this country, we're not quite as barbaric in some of the methods there. And thankfully, there are sort of some laws in place to protect against some other feeding methods there. But as for most of your lizards and that sort of thing, you're talking a box or two of crickets or locusts, millworms, moria worms, something along that sort of line there. Daily feeding or every other day, depending on the species there. But no, it's once you get past the squeamish side of things and you sort of used to dealing with the bugs, it's quite easy, to be fair. I mean, there are also species which don't necessarily require the live feeding. Things like, again, the crested geckos or most of the New Caledonian species there. They are very, very well suited to eating a food called rapashi or pangea, which is it's like a powdered mix that you would mix in with a small bit of water. It kind of makes like a sweet smelling yogurt consistency paste or kind of thing there. And obviously that's a complete diet there. Very, very easy to feed. And of course, for the people that are a little bit more worried about having crickets, locusts or anything similar in the house, these are also a great, great choice of pet there to consider.
And what about the cost? I mean, you mentioned they're relatively inexpensive to actually buy the pet, but then you mentioned maybe £500 in terms of the actual setup cost. Is that the same for if you were to look at lizards, if you were to look at, say, birds? You know, what's the kind of cost difference, I suppose, between the different types of pets that you might be able to help with?
So when it comes to enclosures and that sort of side of things there, I would say small animals are probably going to be the cheaper animals to house there. Things like your typical rabbit hutches, your guinea pig hutches, even your hamster cages will come in far, far cheaper than most reptile supplies there. Reptile supplies aren't overly expensive. I mean, let's talk on your heating equipment, for example, thermostats and things like that. They do look like quite a big outlay initially. I mean, they range from, let's say, £40 up to £80 roughly, depending on what thermostat you're looking for, what brand you're looking for. But of course, all of these items do come with a warranty. And truth be told, I mean, I've been running with the same thermostat successfully now for about 15 years. So these aren't components which are going to fail quickly. It's normally like a one-time outlay. Possibly every now and then there's something to do. For example, with reptile keeping, if you do use UVB tubes, which obviously is quite a vital part of the animal's welfare and setup there, things like the UVB tubes will require replacing sort of every 6 months or so, depending on the manufacturer's recommended specification there. But things like that, I mean, again, you're talking maybe £30 to £50 every 6 months or so. So these aren't big bills that you're going to have regularly. I mean, you're sort of weekly turnover, let's say, would be somewhere in the range of £20 to £30, depending on the animal, of course, and on the enclosure side as well there. I mean, you're talking daily feeding, water, just with a spray, obviously replacing water bowls, etc. And occasionally, sort of every few weeks, a deep clean on the vivarium or the terrarium there, depending on how you keep, of course. I mean, some people choose to go sort of quite, I don't want to say basic, but there's multiple different styles these days of reptile keeping, should we say. So I personally choose to keep most of my animals in bioactive setups. Personally, I believe this is the most natural way to do things because you are, in sense, trying to replicate the natural environment of the animal and provide exactly what climate it would find naturally there. So bioactive, you tend to have things like springtails, things like earthworms, even down to woodlice and that sort of thing. They help as a cleanup crew to keep the soil happy, to keep the vivarium clean. Obviously, they will feed on the waste of the animal, and then essentially they break down the waste, put it back into the soil, so you'll have great plant growth in there, a nice healthy vivarium. And of course, as we all know, plants are very, very good for oxygen as well. So a nice, relaxing, just all round a nice place for the animal to be, if I'm honest there.
Oh, that sounds like a really well-balanced sort of system and something that sounds quite achievable. Dean, if they do need to go to a vet, if they get sick, are you looking at specialist vets here, or have we got enough local knowledge that, you know, you could take them to any local vet?
Unfortunately, this is the side of reptile keeping that can be quite fun. Again, most common pets, as in your dogs, your cats, your small animals, even birds to some extent, will be fine in most veterinary practices. You do find occasionally on the small animal side of things, there are one or two species here and there that vets aren't overly confident with, we've found. I mean, as I've mentioned previously, I keep ferrets and have done for the last 10 years. Finding vets that are well-versed in ferrets can be quite difficult, though thankfully there are some locally to here. With reptiles, it can be a little bit hit and miss, truth be told. Obviously, we're never here to badmouth the industry or veterinary practices as such, but you do see, or have heard of some horror stories, unfortunately, over the years with reptiles going to vets, either misdiagnoses or just not the correct treatments provided. I mean, I've been to a veterinary practice before where they was housing a bearded dragon in quite a small vivarium. Unfortunately, the bearded dragon hadn't had access to either the calcium powder, which you had mentioned with the live food, or the UVB bulbs, which I've mentioned in earlier talk there. And with that, if the UVB isn't provided, the animal can develop something called MBD, which is metabolic bone disease. And with that, unfortunately, the joints and the bones of the animal kind of fuse. So it makes it quite difficult for the animal to move. You tend to find it's normally the back legs that seize there. And again, I mean, I've walked into veterinary practices and seen, as horrible as this may sound, I've seen animals that should have been put down for their own welfare, kept alive just to be an example of what not to do, which, I mean, I personally think if we put the information out there before we get to the point of having these problems is probably the better way to go there. But of course, everyone has a different method. Everyone has a different practice. So,
and if you need to go on holiday, for example, I mean, can you take your snake or your lizard or your ferret to a kennel, Dean?
So, not exactly there. There are multiple businesses. We're quite lucky with where we are, especially in our area of Harpenden here. We have a great exotic pet specialist about 15 minutes down the road from us. Those guys offer boarding, but you do find a lot of the reptile shops that do, or any pet shop, if I'm honest, that does sell or cater to reptiles, normally have some sort of boarding service set up there. Just be a little bit careful with it. It isn't policed quite as heavily as the dog and cat boarding side of things. So just make sure you're checking out insurances, that sort of thing there, just to know ultimately that your animal is going to be in safe hands while you're away. Again, we don't want anyone to have a horror story, and especially when it is the younger children's pets there. Of course, you don't want a great holiday to end in misery when you're returning to find something tragic has happened there. So yes, yeah, always just like I say, have a check of the insurance there. If you do ever have any doubts or hesitations on a place, may not be the place for you, but of course there are a lot of alternatives out there. And if you are ever stuck, of course, feel free to contact us. I can put you in touch with multiple different people around Hertfordshire that do cater to this service, as well as ourselves. We do occasionally offer some boarding depending on time and what's available to us. Obviously everything has to be manageable. I have a lot of pets myself on top of this one. It's like having two full-time jobs at times. But yes, yeah, no, it's like I say, it's always something to consider, but there are certainly options out there for you.
Fantastic. And Dean, can you just tell us a bit about, you know, you were saying there, you mentioned that you've got so many different types of pets. Can you cuddle a gecko? Can you cuddle a ferret?
You've most certainly. Yes, yes. So going back to geckos there are some species which we wouldn't recommend handling. I mean, things like your day geckos, for example, they have sticky pads on their feet to help them climb the glass, but they do have very, very delicate and fragile skin. So animals like the day geckos there, we would recommend more as an observational species. But thankfully, being a day gecko, they are incredibly active during the day. They're a wonder to watch, and obviously they brighten up a room. They are very, very vibrant, small creatures. Don't require too much space there, but yes, yeah. Those, as I say, wouldn't recommend handling those, but something like the crested gecko, let's say, the gargoyle gecko, the leopard gecko, I've referred earlier to New Caledonia. They have a lot of very, very stunning species, in my opinion, and all of those animals are perfectly handleable there. You do occasionally get an animal that can be a little bit nippy. Some of these animals do have, or can be, quite food inclined sort of thing, should we say there. So yeah, just watch fingers around some of them. But no, they are completely handleable. Ferrets can be very, very handleable as well. I mean, well, I've had, over the years now, I think I've had 7 ferrets all in. I do find it tends to be the hobs, which is the male ferret. They, for some strange reason, they seem to be far, far more relaxed and a lot less nippy. Every duo I've had, bar one, has been quite bitey at times. But I mean, the ones we've got now aren't obviously the best example of that. We do have a very, very small Jill who came in from a rescue. She had quite a tragic start to life, and unfortunately, that's resulted in her being quite untrusting of people there. But I mean, we're working with her. She's starting to tame down nicely. If we can get her as sort of tame and handleable as our hop, we'll have two great examples there.
And what do you do in that situation? How do you start to build a relationship with them as a pet, Dean?
It's mainly almost like, the best way I could put it would be, it's similar to bringing a new puppy home for the first time. Most reputable breeders will provide you with an item, let's say a small rug or a small like blanket or something like that, maybe even a t-shirt that has the mother's scent on it. With that, obviously, it just helps the dog feel a little bit more comfortable. It's got a familiar smell there. So with especially with the ferrets, that sort of thing, I've found quite a lot, the more time I spend around them guys, not necessarily handling them, we're very, very lucky to have quite a large enclosure here. If I do spend time just either sat in the room with them, if I'm sat in the enclosure with them, or of course between customers, if they're out in our laps, things like that, it just gives them a time to get used to our smell. It becomes the familiar scent for them, and it isn't something sort of new and scary approaching them. I mean, ferrets are quite a nervous species. They are a prey animal in the wild. So with that, you do find they are a little bit more hesitant around most people. But again, regular handling, take the time to build the bond there, and you'll have a great success. I mean, hamsters are another prime example. They do tend to be quite nippy, unfortunately. They're a good household favourite for many, many small children there, or young children, should we say. But again, it's ultimately the time that you put into the animal will make your experience of owning that animal far more enjoyable. And as I say, it is mainly just you have to bear with a few bites here and there, unfortunately. It's always going to happen, especially with a new addition. I mean, things like the transport home can be quite nerve-wracking for a creature that small. It's a scenario I've never encountered before. There's a lot of unfamiliar smells, as I've mentioned. So yeah, it's ultimately just spending a bit of time with the animal. I mean, I know with a very, very obscure one, but on the topic of small animals, there's something like the sugar glider. Now, sugar gliders, again, are very, very nervous little creatures, unfortunately. They're beautiful animals, absolutely stunning things. They're incredibly just interesting to watch as well with the way they can glide around. But again, with those, they do tend to be quite nervous. And I know it's highly, highly recommended if you do have free time, if you're at home, most people would pop them into a jumper pocket. Let's say if you've got a shirt or anything like that with a pocket there, pop them into there. They'll settle down and sleep in your pocket nice and secure in a nice tight space. But again, they're taking in that scent and getting used to it. So as soon as they sort of recognize that scent, you'll notice quite a big change in the animal's behavior and how they'll approach you as well, where as I say, it's not something unfamiliar to them at that point.
Dean, I love the sound of this sugar glider. Tell me more. What is a sugar glider?
So the sugar glider, the best way I can put it, they're a bit like if a hamster and a flying squirrel was to have a baby. They're a very, very small, very, very small little animal there. Spend most of their time up in trees. They're not a common pet in the industry, if I'm honest. They do have their downfalls, but like I say, they are a stunning looking little animal. So they would be found, I'm unfortunately not exactly sure of their location. They're one of the animals I haven't kept before, so I haven't done a whole lot of research on, truth be told. But from what I know of those, they live up high in trees, they'll eat fruits, they'll eat insects and that sort of thing. But I do have a habit to, unfortunately, spray when they use the bathroom. So they don't make great household pets. They are quite a smelly one. They don't toilet train very well. And as I mentioned, they are quite nippy, unfortunately, as well. But unfortunately, a beautiful looking little animal there.
Oh, your passion for this obviously just shines through talking to you, Dean. You're obviously very knowledgeable and experienced, but also very passionate about pet care. If some of our listeners want to find out a bit more, if they want to come in perhaps and talk to you and just benefit from this absolute wealth of knowledge, how can they find you?
So we are on Facebook and Instagram. We are under Creature Comforts Harpenden on both accounts. The only thing I do need to mention there is we do have an old account that is still active on the Facebook there from our previous location in Vaughan Road. The one that is now, it has the logo of Creature Comforts Pet Supplies and obviously linked to our new Southdown location. We're always happy and ready to answer messages there. You can contact us in store on the telephone there as well. Again, hours are 10 till 5 there any time of day. Give us a call if you need a chat, or alternatively pop in and see us. I always find it's best to do things face to face there. But any way we can help, please feel free to get in touch with us.
Fantastic. And just tell us again, Dean, you're based in Southdown. Are you on the high street there, or are you tucked away?
So we're a little bit tucked away, unfortunately. We used to have a far more sort of easily accessible premises down in Harpenden town there, but for the last 2 years we have been on an industrial estate in Southdown, which is, if you was coming through Southdown, if let's say for co-ops on your right hand side, go past the co-op, past the Plough and Harrow, and take the next right turn before the railway bridge, follow that track right up to the top, and we are the very first building top left there for you.
Fantastic. And I guess one of the things about being off the high street now is that you have parking facilities, which I'm guessing if you're lugging equipment for pets in and out, might be quite a useful thing to know too.
Without a doubt, yes. Yeah, the parking has been a blessing, I must admit. We don't have a lot of parking here, but we do have two available customer spaces. Parking, of course, is free of charge, unlike the town now, which, as I say, has been a huge, huge bonus for us recently. Parking is pretty much always readily available. Our landlord here, thankfully, is very, very kind to us as well. So if you do come up and find that both spaces are taken, we do have a small island just at the front of the shop. Feel free to park there. You won't be in anyone's way. There's no ticketing or anything like that to worry about. Saturdays do tend to be a little bit easier if people are popping up here. Most of the industrial estate is closed on a Saturday, so parking is far more readily available as well there for everyone.
Oh, fantastic. So I'm just imagining, families bundling out of the car with the children children and then bundling back in with their newly purchased pet equipment. You know, that's got to be a useful bit of information to know that you can get in and out easily.
Definitely. I will throw it out there as well, just while we're on the topic. We do also offer free home delivery from here. We offer delivery Monday through until Saturday. Deliveries, depending on staff at the time. Normally, we work with deliveries from 5 o'clock onwards here. But again, things like even your bigger bag of dog food, we do understand some people don't want to carry it, or let's say aren't capable of carrying it. So we like to cater to everyone. We like everyone to feel involved here. So whatever we can do to make your life easy, as I say, please feel free to get in contact with us.
Oh, thank you, Dean. And what's next? What's next on your to-do list or your to-have list in the pet world?
Oh, so it depends what avenue we're approaching this from, if I'm honest. So for the shop, we'll have a lot more treats coming in the next few weeks. We've just received all of the new racking, so we're looking forward to getting that built up over the weekend. I believe the new stock should be arriving in next week as well, so we'll have a lot more, a much vaster range of our natural treats there. For myself, with animal keeping, there's a few species on the list at the moment. I'm not rushing into anything too much at the minute. Obviously, space is always something to consider, and I do have quite a large collection at this point. But I would absolutely love to get myself another Kilbelly lizard to partner up and potentially mate with mine. I've been keeping the Kilbellies now for about 3.5 years, and they've been an absolutely fantastic species to keep there. Incredibly vibrant colours. Again, an animal that isn't nocturnal, which sometimes can be a little bit rare in the reptile side of a hobby. Just obviously, again, it depends what time you have, what you ultimately want to get out of the animal. I absolutely love a lot of the nocturnal species, but of course, if you do want an animal that isn't going to be grumpy daytime, obviously they aren't sometimes the best options there for everyone. But I mean, yeah, so as I say, looking for potentially another Kilbelly at some point. Would quite like to get into amphibians. It's been quite a while since I've kept any amphibians now. I think it's been probably 5 or 6 years since I've last had any now. And at some point, we'll be looking to get another dog as well, because unfortunately, we had to have ours put to sleep a few weeks ago. So,
I'm sorry.
Quite a hole there at the moment, and the house feels a little bit quiet, truth be told. But again, don't want to jump into anything too quickly. We always recommend, especially when it does come to dogs, obviously dogs are a lot more of a commitment than some animals are. Just their daily sort of requirements are much greater than some animals there. So it's one of those. We always recommend people do really take their time in selecting a dog there. Just not every dog is well suited to every household, should we say. I mean, things like the Husky, for example, they can take upwards of 4 hours of walking a day. It doesn't always fit in with most people's sort of routine there. It isn't the easiest thing to get in as well. So as I say, it's always something to consider. But yeah, we'll be doing our research for probably the next 6 months or so before we make a decision on what breed we'll take on next there. But no, looking forward to seeing what the future holds, definitely.
Well, you've absolutely helped, I'm sure, some of our listeners with some of their initial research, Dean, and given them a lot of food for thought. You've certainly given me a lot of things to think about too. And I'm so grateful that you could come and join us today and just share so much information and knowledge on this subject. Thank you so much.
Once again, thank you for the opportunity. But no, we are incredibly grateful to be here. This is obviously what we want to do and where we'd like to stay. So whatever we can do to get our voices out there, get our name out there as well, but ultimately to ensure that everyone has as good of a time as we do keeping animals.
Fabulous. Thanks, Dean.
Thank you.
So we're going to take a little break on the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. We'll be back with more chat in just a few minutes, so stay tuned.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Now, you may remember our Duke of Edinburgh's volunteering students, Archie and Dylan, who came on the programme a couple of weeks ago, and they're doing their own interviews as part of their volunteering project. This week they're back, and they're talking to Julius from Julius's Super Soccer School.
Hello, I'm Archie.
And I'm Dylan, and we're volunteering at Mix 92.6 as part of a Silver Duke of Edinburgh, where we'll be bringing you perspectives about issues we hope parents and carers are interested in.
Today we'll be discussing the importance of sport in the lives of young people. We're really happy today to be joined by Julius from Super Soccer School in the studio.
Hi Julius, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me here.
It's good to have you. Thank you for joining us on the Parents Show. Tell us about your company, Super Soccer School, and why you set it up.
So we're a company we coach kids from 2 to 16 years old in a fun learning environment. I set it up originally, got into coaching and wanted to create a full-time job for myself because I really enjoyed the coaching. It's something I really enjoyed and I thought got relatively good at. And I thought that was the only way of doing it. It's very hard to get into full-time football coaching without much experience. So I went ahead and started my own.
That's very interesting. What would you say are the physical and mental benefits of doing sports?
Starting with the physical, things like strength, stamina, cardiovascular health as well. It can help fight obesity in children, adults, as well as other diseases as well. I won't pretend that I know about all the diseases though. But yeah, there's loads of benefits as far as physical benefits and then mental benefits as well. And from the mental side, it can help with things like anxiety, can help out with kids and adults' confidence as well through competence. The more you practice, you get good at something. As far as team sports as well, there's lots of soft skills you can learn, like leadership, communication. Yeah, there's a vast amount of mental benefits for it.
Cool. So do you think that some sports are better than other sports for like improving people's physical and mental health?
Well, I think that depends on the goal, really. So if you was looking at something for strength and stamina, maybe a bit of weightlifting for strength would be a good one, or stamina, you could join a track team or do some running. Team sports are particularly good for social skills. So it depends on the goal, really.
Do you say there's a big difference between the advantages of sports and exercise?
So I'd say that it's exercise would be more of a personal thing. So adding strength through weightlifting, stamina through swimming or running, whereas the sports can have all of that, but with a social and a competitive part to it. So I personally think that the sports can give you a little bit more. But I think it depends on preference, really.
Very interesting.
So to add a sort of competitive aspect to it, how would you say younger generations compare to previous ones in terms of getting active?
Well, because of technology, I think that there's a lot more screen time for the younger generations now. So they're probably most likely less active than older generations. Maybe we haven't caught up with technology ourselves as a population. But I don't think it's as bad as some people tend to make it out to be. I know that kids are very interested in physical activity, even if they do also like to sit in front of the screen, whether that's, you know, playing a PlayStation or on a tablet. But physical activity is important, whether that was for the older generation or younger ones now. I'd like to think I'm somewhere in the middle, not too old. So I sort of grew up with some of the new technologies that you guys have nowadays. And even though stuff like your TikToks and your Instagrams wasn't around when I was younger, I still find myself getting caught in front of the screen a lot. So it does take a little bit of effort, regardless of what generation you're from.
Mm. Do you think that there should be more effort from older people to encourage young, like children, to participate more in sports?
Absolutely. I do think that sometimes it's situational. So if you know, parents... I'll just mention the screens and the tablets. Parents might put a tablet in front of the kid when, you know, before dinner and things like that, when maybe it's not always the most beneficial thing to do. But I do understand as well that parents have a lot going on, and having a kid running around the house all day after they've just got back from a day of work is quite difficult. But at the same time, yes, I think adults have that responsibility, whether that is a parent, teacher, coaches like myself or anyone in the community. I think it takes a village to sort of raise kids. And yeah, it's really important that we all push it. Also, we're lucky enough in this area to have some really nice facilities, but we could always do with more. And I know there's other areas around the UK and other parts of the world that could really benefit from more facilities, more opportunities to be able to do those things.
That's quite interesting. Just to turn it on its head, would you say that there needs to be more emphasis on getting older people to partake in more sports?
Absolutely. I think maybe as you get older, you need to take a lot more responsibility on yourself. However, again, as far as the resources and opportunities, there are lots out there, but we could, you know, the more the merrier. And it's so important for older people to keep moving and stuff like strength training, because as you get older, again, I'm not like a scientist or anything, but the bone density gets, you know, they get more fragile, muscles sort of degrade, for lack of a better word. So you need to keep moving and keep exercising in order to sort of maintain that muscle rather than necessarily grow it. So yeah, it's really important. There are stuff though, like walking football is a good one. If they're able to play football, fantastic. But obviously, if you're less mobile as an older person, having the fact that you don't have to run, you can walk, is a little bit easier on the joints. Swimming is an excellent one. Stationary bikes and things like that. But yeah, definitely more opportunity, the better.
Very interesting. So how do you think people who aren't very interested in sports could gain an interest and start getting more active?
Well, a good way to do it is just to try things. I think it's just like anything in life. You know, you don't know what you like until you've had a go at it. So the more things you try, eventually, I think it's inevitable you're going to come across something that you like. It might also be a good idea to try things for a social reason rather than a you know, purely let's just try sports. I've got loads of kids who come to my soccer school, football training, that initially they come for social reasons. Their mates are there, so they want to come and enjoy some time with their friends. I know for Archie that may or may not have been the case, but I know that you like football as well, but you've got friends in that session, so that might be the reason why you come to mine instead of another one, right?
Yeah, no, it's definitely a big kind of reason why.
Yeah, it adds to it, doesn't it, for sure. So I think that's a way of getting into it as well. Try it socially. Hopefully it's the right environment, because that helps. And, you know, you sort of grow to love things, especially as you become more competent at it. It's difficult to enjoy something when you feel hopeless at it. You know what I mean? Like me interviewing right now, for example. No, I'm having a great time. But the more you practice something, the better you get at something. I feel like you will start to enjoy it because you're able to do more with it.
Do you think that social media could be used to promote sports in any way?
Yeah, of course. I think we have to, in whatever sport we're in, we have to keep up with the times. So social media is here to stay. And I think definitely it can help. For example, you guys, I'm sure you've watched highlights of football on YouTube, some skills, maybe your favourite player, you know, top 10 skills from, I don't know, who's your favourite player?
I used to watch a lot of Eden Hazard.
Eden Hazard, great example. He's got fantastic highlight reel, right? He does some crazy stuff. So stuff like, yeah, you could definitely integrate social media into it to promote, either through highlights where kids are watching these things and emulating their idols. And then as well, you know, a coach like myself could go ahead and say, you know, this is a show for the parents, right? And guardians. I could go on there, which I should be doing, and demonstrating some activities that you can do with your kid in the park. You know, so there's definitely loads of opportunity in social media to promote sports.
Thanks for that. Do you remember doing your lockdown sessions for the football?
Yeah, it was, it feels like ages ago now, but it was quite experimental doing those virtual sessions. And there was, you know, some challenges, you know, keeping you guys engaged through a screen and in a little space I had in my front room as well. But yeah, no, I do. And it was challenging, but it was a lot of fun. It was good. The most fun we could have without being able to leave our house, but we made the best of it, I think. How did you find them, Archie?
Well, I think the point of it was kind of to get active. I don't know if I really engaged with that put so much. but I enjoyed myself still. It was kind of the closest thing you got to exercise at that point.
Yeah, I think it definitely came from a good place. Whether it benefited or not, we'll see. But hey, if we ever have to go back into lockdown, which, you know, knock on wood that we don't, but it would be better next time, Archie. So I do apologize.
So if somebody's listening to the show and they want to get their child into your soccer school, how would they go about doing that?
So yeah, you can find us on our website, supersoccerschool.co.uk, bit of a mouthful. And yeah, have a look at what we've got on the website or send us a message, and it's me on the other side of the emails, so I'll be the one replying. That's how you can find us. And I know that you'd love our session as well.
Thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
No worries, Dylan. I've really enjoyed myself. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Archie. No, it's been really good. Thank you very much.
Thank you to Archie and Dylan and Julius there. Now, I think everybody's aware of the drive to ban smartphones in schools, but at Praywood Primary School in St Albans, some of the Year 6 students have set up a tech tribe, and it's all about advocating a smartphone-free childhood. Ellie from Mixed Mornings talked to Year 6 teacher Tom Pugh, who tells her how it came about, but really hands over the credit to the students with the work they have done. They're very passionate about their cause. Here, all the tough questions are answered by Lily, William and Miles, Thomas, Chloe, Amelia and Layla.
It's something we've started this year. We haven't previously done it before, but with the parent-led smartphone-free childhood movement taking off kind of nationally, but also regionally, this has been a bit of a hotspot for it. I know Hitchin and St Albans, that happened in the kind of surrounding areas, have kind of taken it on. We had parents that were interested here about how they could start that going. And so as a school, we've just sought to do what we can in order to kind of facilitate that for the parents, but then also for the children, because in order for it to be meaningful, the kind of education point needs to come for them. They need to begin to understand what the risks are so that they can make the decisions for themselves, not purely relying on the parents to set that boundary and say, I'm not buying you a smartphone. So we've, as you'll be able to hear, got some very passionate Year 6s this year who are on the whole leading it. I feel a slight fraud talking to you about it, because actually a lot of this comes from them and their passion for the subject.
Brilliant. Well, let's hand straight over to the kids to find out more about it. What is the Tech Tribe and what kind of things do you do?
So I'm Lily, and the Tech Tribe is something that we wanted to set up because we wanted children to say their point of view about smartphone-free childhoods. And we like to say that it's the children's future, so they should say their bit about it. And we also think that because we are the oldest in the school and we're Tech Tribe, we could be good role models for the younger children, and we think that the message would be a lot better coming from other children. So what we do is we have organised some parent workshops where parents come in and teachers talk about different social media platforms and how to keep your child safe on social media. And we've also had an expert panel where a PCSO came in, some parents came in, and some people in marketing came in, where we sat down and listened to what they had to say about it so we could educate ourselves to educate other people in the school. And we also did a Safe Internet Day assembly to Key Stage 1 and Key Stage 2, where we talked about how to be safe online and also did some examples and situations and how you should deal with those situations. And we're a new group, so we're still thinking about what we would like to do as we go. And a thing that we would like to do is a podcast to inform everyone about how to be safe on the internet, and also we want everyone to try and learn this message.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Lily. So next question, what is the smartphone-free childhood movement?
I'm William.
And I'm Miles. The smartphone-free childhood movement is not about banning phones, but about banning smartphones for kids.
This is happening so children can have a happier and healthier childhood without the dangers of the internet.
It's a parent-led movement that was not started by any schools.
If someone has a smartphone and is fully exposed to the internet, but their friend doesn't, they might feel very left out, or it would be unfair.
So, it would just be better if no children got smartphones in the first place.
So, should children have no access to technology at all?
I don't think it's really about that, because screen is quite, and you can have educational sites. I just don't think we should reduce the amount of smartphones given to children, because then they have less risk of, for example, being scammed or listening to fake news and thinking it's real. But if it's on, for example, an iPad that parents have, then the parents can get the scams first and then tell their children about the scams. We also want to try and stop social media for kids, because kids might find something on there that's very much not for their age group. For example, something about a horror movie or something even racist. We also would think that it's okay to have a brick phone just for communications, though.
So what would you say to parents feeling under pressure to give their 11-year-old a smartphone?
I'm Chloe. Most parents have felt under pressure to give their child a smartphone due to peer pressure. Though smartphones are great, they're not made for 11-year-olds. They are aimed at adults. Your child can feel left out because of other people having a smartphone, but stick to this and it can improve their mental health and academics. To stop the peer pressure, we all need to do this, otherwise it can feel really unfair on the children.
So how else can children and parents stay connected?
I'm Amelia, and you don't have to buy them a flip phone, or you don't have to make them stay in media or social media or Facebook or any of that, when you can just get them a watch that can phone or call, or just get a flip phone that can phone or call, and you can stay in contact with your child. On a watch or the flip phone, you can locate their position and your child can connect to their friends if they have a watch too. And when you're exposed to the internet, they are not safe being with devices and learning what is going to happen. So let's all be in this together, and then no one will feel left out.
So what are the benefits to children being smartphone free?
Hi, I'm Layla. Having a smartphone does reduce less stress, as they're not being exposed to everything online. It also reduces online bullying, as they can then control how people send messages to them because they don't have a smartphone. Most people who get smartphones lose their ability to use their imagination, not literally, but for example, if you ask them what to do, they might resort to using a device. Not having a smartphone improves overall well-being and mental health.
That was some of the Tech Tribe from St Albans Primary School, Praywood, talking about the benefits of having a smartphone-free childhood.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.